Welcome everyone to Animal Voices. Gandhi said that the strength of a nation can be judged on how it treats its wheat. And Leo Tolstoy said, as long as there are slaughterhouses, there will be battlefields. Yes, there is a great need for animals to be liberated from legislated cruelty. In this program, we envision a world where human beings will no longer kill, maim, or exploit animals for food or any other purpose. We also envisage a world where the human race will finally make peace with the animal kingdom, and we recognize that they are not commodities who have no feelings, but these animals have a right to live a decent life just as much as you and me. In this long struggle for animal liberation, let us take heart from Gandhi, who challenged the greatest military might on earth at that time and proved that the powerless had power and that the power of the spirit will prevail over the might of the military. Yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, affectionately known as Co-op Radio, your community-based and community-sponsored radio station. This program is presented to you by volunteer members of Earth Save Canada, the Vancouver Humane Society, and the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. Marge Adams, our regular co-host, is away in Eastern Canada, and Alan Jensen is in the control room. Mine is Carl Loskin, and in the studio today we have John Pranger. Hello, John.
Hi, Carl.
What will you be doing today?
I'll be talking about the manufacture of polio vaccine.
Right, thanks. And within a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Christiane Wilhelmsen, and she's on, and she will tell us how to, from the Georgia Strait Alliance, and she will tell us how to improve the sewage systems in the Georgia Strait. In the Georgia Strait, some 70% of British Columbians work and play. Welcome to Animal Voices. Christiane Wilhelmsen.
Thanks for having me on your show.
That's great. Now, in the olden days, it was said that dilution is the problem to the pollution problem. We dilute it and we pour it into the Georgia Strait. Mm-hmm. That might not apply now with such a large population, with increasing population in the Georgia Strait area. Maybe you could tell us about how the sewage is being treated and where it is in the Georgia Strait area.
Sure. I mean, what I can tell you about sewage is that obviously every community has a sewage issue to deal with. We have to think about how we treat our sewage. And you raise a good point. I mean, there was a time when dilution was the solution to pollution, and we had smaller communities, and we also had a lot less chemicals in the world that we lived in. So now sewage is a far more complicated thing to deal with because it contains not just organic matter, but a wide and growing amount of chemicals. Everything you ingest from pharmaceuticals onward, you know, becomes part of sewage. And then there are just chemicals like PCBs and other things are part of our sewage. So it's a complicated issue. And throughout British Columbia, unfortunately, we don't have a standard way of dealing with it in the most effective way, which will be good for our health and good for the health of the environment. So you'll have communities like Victoria and Prince Rupert that dump their sewage raw. You have cities like Whistler that treat their sewage at a very high level and removing a lot of the harmful matter from it. And then you have the greater Vancouver area where it's a bit of a patchwork as well, where we have 5 treatment plants in this region. 2 of them only treat at a primary level, which means that they only take out some of the chemicals, some of the organic stuff. But the rest is dumped into Burrard Inlet and the Fraser River and Georgia Strait. So this is as you can see, it's a bit of a complex problem, but also every community seems to be dealing with it in a different way.
Now, maybe you can tell us, where are these outlets? You said there were five outlets here. Mm-hmm. Of all the sewage from the, well, I guess there's a lot of sewage coming down the Fraser River as well.
Well, there are five, as I said, there are five treatment plants. The primary ones, which are, the ones that don't treat to a very high level, one of them's right underneath the Lions Gate Bridge. So if you drive over Lions Gate, just look down and you'll see the treatment plant there. There's also one, the Ina plant, which is in South Vancouver. And then you have three other plants. One is the Anisus Island plant, the Lulu Island plant, and then there's another one in Langley. So we have all these outfalls which have sewage treated to varying levels. And the other thing we have in Vancouver and the greater Vancouver area are things called combined sewage overflows. So there are pipes throughout the region which actually, depending on how much rain we're getting, can dump raw sewage right into our waters. Combined sewage overflows are basically where stormwater and sewage are mixed together when the treatment plants can't handle the amount of water that's coming in. So that is slowly being replaced, but it's literally on a probably another 45-year timeline before it's replaced. So you can see we definitely have a problem in the greater Vancouver area.
Now, what the planning is for the time being for, let's just mention Iona Island and what's happening under the Lionsgate Bridge, that wonderful place where all the tourists go, is primary treatment. So what is primary treatment?
Primary treatment is also referred to as mechanical treatment. It's essentially a settling tank. So basically sewage goes in there and whatever floats to the top, that is oils and greases and so on, and whatever sinks to the bottom, which would be a lot of the fecal matter, all that is removed and then the rest is dumped out into the waters. So, it is your first level of treatment for sewage.
Now, you have a figure of how many millions of liters of sewage is being pumped into the Georgia Strait every day from Iona Island and I guess from the Georgia Strait.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have exact numbers, but I can tell you between those two plants, over 50% of the sewage in the greater Vancouver area goes to those two plants, which means that half of our sewage is not being treated to a level which the European Union and the United States deem as minimum. So those two areas and countries have decided that secondary is the absolute minimum you should have. We here have not yet come on board with that idea. And so half of the sewage in the greater Vancouver area is not treated to what other countries consider it a minimum standard.
Now, the outrageous aspect of this, as far as I'm concerned, is that only by the year 2020, they're planning to upgrade the system.
Exactly. I mean, there are actually two timelines. Lionsgate is, the plan is to upgrade it by 2020, as you mentioned. Iona, not until 2030. So these are incredibly long timelines and far too long as far as we're concerned, because until then, these sewage treatment plants will be dumping basically toxic chemicals and a lot of biological matter into our oceans every single day, and that's simply unacceptable. And it's simply something that we can fix. I mean, we know how to solve the problem. We know secondary treatment's there. And the exciting, there is actually some exciting thing about upgrading treatment is that there are new technologies being used around the world which not only treat sewage but allow us to actually get resources out of our sewage. Actually, the Anisus Island plant, they get heat. They actually, from that plant, some of the heat that's produced is actually used at the plant in order to lower costs. So that idea is already here in Greater Vancouver, but we could go a step further. We could be using technologies that would allow us to get biogas and biodiesel out of our sewage, that would allow us to get heat, would allow us to recycle the water. Just think about how much water we use in our sewage. So every time we flush the toilet, all that water, we could actually be recapturing some of that water and using it. So this is actually, you know, it would be really a positive thing if the Greater Vancouver Regional District not only sped up those timelines so that they weren't polluting the environment, but also thought of this as an opportunity to start thinking about sewage as a resource, not as waste.
It's so wonderfully encouraging to hear what you say, and that the Georgia Strait Alliance, maybe you can give people your webpage, is promoting a cleaner environment.
Certainly. Our website is www.georgiastrait.org, and you can learn all the things that I've mentioned in the last 10 minutes. All that, there's lots of background information on our website under the Clean Air and Water Program, and people are welcome to see that and all the other programs that, and issues that we work on in the Georgia Strait region.
I'd like to just go back about, you were speaking about the PCBs and all these chemicals, and let's say the sewage from, let's take the North Shore. Mm-hmm. There's some 76,000 households in the whole of the North Shore. So all, whatever comes from the toilets there, the human excrement, feces, you say it goes to the, it all goes to under the Lionsgate Bridge, mm-hmm. and it goes into settling tanks there. And if I get this right, you said about 50% of this fecal matter from the 76,000 hose settles at the bottom, but 50% of it goes into the ocean right there under the Lionsgate Bridge, gets treated with chlorine, mm-hmm. but it doesn't negate the chemicals that people are consuming, the estrogens, the there was a great uproar in the UK about women consuming birth control, taking birth control pills, but that these estrogens were then in the urine. And I mean, that would not be cleaned out. It would not settle to the bottom. That's going straight into the Georgia Strait, isn't it?
Well, some of the chemicals will be removed, but not the greatest proportion. If we had secondary treatment at Lions Gate, it would be taking out 90% of the chemicals that you're talking about, the endocrine disrupting chemicals. So you're right. I mean, some of these chemicals are going right onto BRT. And when you think about endocrine disrupting chemicals and hormones and so on, I mean, there are fish, there are marine mammals out in there, and they are swimming through that. And over time, you know, you are going to start seeing impacts on wildlife that are a part of our natural environment. So yeah, it's one of those situations where we know what's going out into the water, and we know how to solve the problem, and it's secondary sewage treatment.
So it's not only affecting all this. I mean, under the Lionsgate Bridge, you have the Capilano River there, mm-hmm. and we have many of these fish, the salmon that go to spawn, they can spend months there in a basic cesspool of pollutants, PCBs, fecal matter from humans.
That is certainly one of our concerns, is that these fish are swimming through what's coming out of the Lionsgate plant. Well, and as you, I mean, we're all very concerned throughout British Columbia with our salmon runs and the health of our salmon runs, because it's important to us both as communities but also economically, and yet we are putting at risk these salmon runs by exposing these fish to the chemicals that are coming out of our undertreated sewage.
Now, when this untreated sewage settles down and there's quite a riptide going underneath the Lionsgate Bridge, and it goes up all Indian Way, Indian Arm Way with the tide, it settles on the ground. And I had a friend who likes to pick up crabs there, but surely, and he says, they are so big here.
Well, I can't speak to the exact connection between what's coming out of the sewage and certainly the size of the crabs. But you know, the reality is, crab eat what's on the bottom of our shores. And you know, if some of it includes fecal matter from our treatment plant and chemicals, that ends up in the crab wheat and the fish wheat. I mean, the best way to think about that is, you know, sometimes what comes out of our sewage treatment plants end up on our dinner plates. And this is why we should be very concerned about the way province-wide we approach sewage. We are, you know, in a sense, lucky to live along a beautiful, beautiful coastline. Yet, we are you know, using it as a toilet. And this is just absolutely inappropriate and not the way. The ocean is not a big dumping pool for things that we don't want to deal with.
Now, Tourism Vancouver shows as one of its main features the glories of Stanley Park, and that is somebody with a fishing rod standing underneath the Lionsgate Bridge.
I suspect that with a lot of people in the Greater Vancouver area don't know where the sewage treatment plants are, and I suspect people at Tourism Victoria may not have been aware that, you know, just right below the Lionsgate Bridge is one of our treatment plants.
No.
And, you know, I hope that this conversation and many conversations we're having with people will make people in our community aware that we, A, have treatment plants here and that we're not dealing with our sewage in an environmentally friendly way.
Now, before we get to your action with the Sierra Legal Defense Fund, there's been new legislation from the federal government here regarding cruise ships and recreational boaters because,
yes.
I mean, is that adequate there, what is being legislated now, and how does it impact the Georgia Strait and your wonderful organization, the Georgia Strait Alliance?
The new shipping regulation affecting big ships and recreational boaters is coming into play on the 15th, so next week it becomes law. The new regulations are a big step forward. So it actually puts us more on par with the international regulations. So from that perspective, these regulations are very positive things. The problem with those regulations is, unfortunately, they've been designed in such a way that it will be very hard to comply with them. For recreational boaters in particular, who within 5 years are going to have to holding tanks so that they are not dumping even their small amounts of sewage in very sensitive areas. They will have to have a holding tank and pump it out. There are two problems with that. One of them, of course, is that there aren't enough pump-out stations, and there are no plans to put new pump-out stations. There's no money for that. So that's going to make it hard for boaters. But if you think about it, too, if there's a pump-out station in, for example, Prince Rupert, well, a boater will pump out their sewage into the Prince Rupert system, and they don't have sewage treatment. So you can see the irony with you where you have stronger regulations for boaters but weak regulations for municipalities, and therefore they don't drive very well. The good news, though, is that the federal government is in the process of developing national standards, finally, for sewage treatment. We don't know what they're going to look like in the end, but I think it's going to go a long way to helping develop a little bit more of an even playing field so we don't have this kind of very confusing regulations and confusing systems where everyone seems to be treating sewage differently, and that ends up being very harmful for the environment.
Now, these cruise ships that hold some 5,000 people, they have, of course, enormous holding tanks. Mm-hmm. And I thought I saw a suggested guideline here that if they were 12 miles outside of the... I guess outside of, I don't know what, the land.
It's 12 nautical miles from shore.
From shore,
they
could
dump
everything?
Yes.
That's outrageous.
But there are still regulations on what the quality of, you know, because you have to understand that cruise ships also have sewage treatment on them. And that, you know, this is an interesting point, is that a lot of the cruise ships that come out of Vancouver and go up to Alaska are now have sewage treatment on board. And that's not because of any regulations in Canada, because Canada has no regulations that apply to cruise ships. It's because Alaska has really, really strong regulations. And you may have heard last week how there's now going to be a tax on cruise ships, and that money, part of that money will be used for environmental protection. Alaska's way ahead of us, and that's actually helping us by actually putting treatment on cruise ships. But you know, there's a valid point in that they're still allowed to dump once they get further enough from shore. And that still shows a certain attitude about how we treat the oceans, which is regrettable.
Now, together, the Sierra Legal Defense Fund and, of course, the Georgia Strait Alliance, of which you are such a wonderful member, spokesperson Christiane Wilhelmsen, you've actually been involved in encouraging a lawsuit claiming to the provincial government that they're in contravention of the Fisheries Act. How is that going ahead?
Well, what has actually happened is we are laying a private, what it's called is a private information or private prosecution. It isn't actually a lawsuit. And represented by Sierra Legal, along with, there are two other clients on this, Teabuck Suzuki Environmental Foundation and the United Fishermen's Union. And so what a private prosecution is basically is if a citizen, you know, it could be you, could be me, anybody, has evidence that a law or regulation has perhaps been violated, they can lay a private information, which is essentially presenting that information to the court. So we are in the process of doing that. We have not had the opportunity to lay our information before the court. That'll happen at the end of the month. But we do believe that there have been violations of the Fisheries Act at the Lionsgate treatment plant, which is why we went to court in early August. And right now we are just waiting for the opportunity to present our evidence.
Well, the evidence is overwhelming. We really appreciate you being so much involved in ensuring that for posterity we have a cleaner environment. And give us your web page, and people can see much of what you've said here on your web page, and maybe encourage what you're doing by giving you a donation.
Thank you very much for that, and it's been a pleasure to be on your show. Our website is www.georgiastrait.org.
Thank you.
Wait a minute. I have a question.
Can John has a question.
Sure.
Other countries have been turning this sewage sludge into biogas. Can you talk a little bit about that?
She did.
I'm sorry, you did.
I did, yes. And there's lots of information on our website with examples of what other communities have done. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But yes, all that information is on our website. It's a very positive thing, and I hope that communities in British Columbia will start turning those to those technologies.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for being on Animal Voices. We've been speaking to Christiane Willemsen from the Georgia Strait Alliance. Thank you. And you're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Yes, and this coming weekend, that's tomorrow, shortly we'll be having Maureen Bragg from the Save Our Shores on our program. She'll be telling us about a wonderful event that's going to be happening on the shores and the North Shore. It's a beach cleanup from Kate's Park. And so we'll have her on in about 5 minutes. But before we do that, we have another event happening at the Parkgate Community Center. It's called Parkgate Days, and that's in North Vancouver. And what they have is part of their event is from on Saturday, September the 9th, that's tomorrow. It says here from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., the Reptile Man will be there. Reptile Man, yes. And underneath there is a caption that says, encouraging people to come and see the Reptile Man by, it says here, enjoy playing with the snakes. Well, I phoned Paul Springate from the Reptile Refuge Education Center, and he is absolutely outraged that the public should be coming to Parkgate Days to enjoy playing with the snakes. He is outraged that people continuously think that they can manhandle these animals because, he says, they are not toys. There is absolutely no educational value in handling these reptiles. Poor animals, reptiles, they spend their lives sitting in a plastic box and then get manhandled for short periods by people and children. The Reptile Refuge Education Center in Surrey is absolutely inundated with abandoned reptiles, people who are encouraged by shows like the Reptile Man puts on, and the community, Parkgate community would encourage people to enjoy playing with the reptiles. These animals grow to be a large size. The children lose interest in them. They become abandoned reptiles, and they're handed over to the Reptile Refuge for care. Well, So we're really concerned that this should be happening on the North Shore, and that this is that there is not an awareness that I believe last week somebody had a caiman put his hand in the caiman's cage, and promptly got his hand bit. Well, while we're waiting for Maureen Bragg to give us a call, John, do you have something? Otherwise, we'll go and have a little bit of music.
Have you talked about that, Carl?
It's coming on.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming on.
Oh, okay.
The beach cleanup.
Well, here's a news item. Probably everybody's heard that the European Parliament issued a declaration yesterday, or the day before, rather, demanding that the European Union ban importation of seal products in what animal rights activists say could spell the end of Canada's commercial seal hunt. The written declaration, signed, supported by 368 European Union legislators, aims to shut the European market for seal hides and fur from Canada.
That's great. And over to Alan, and we'll have a little bit of music. Yes, and you've been listening to John Reichman, and his CD is called Up in the Woods, and the cut that you just heard is called The North Shore. How appropriate, after having the people talk about the sewage plants at under Lionsgate Bridge and what's happening there. And right now we have on our line Maureen Bragg. And she is from the Save Our Shores, which is a North Vancouver organization. And they're sponsoring the annual beach cleanup from Maplewood Mudflats to Panorama Park this coming Saturday. Welcome to Animal Voices, Maureen Bragg.
Yes. Hello, Carl.
Yes, and of course the Save Our Shores has a wonderful beach cleanup program for this coming Saturday. So maybe you can just tell us a bit about it and encourage people to come out to the wonderful North Shore.
Well, we've been doing this for about 7 years now. I think this is our seventh year. We organize the walk in July, which many people come on, and then we have the cleanup after the summer months. The reason for it is to raise public awareness to the beauty of our beaches, but also the necessity to preserve them. And after the summer months, as you can imagine, there's quite a bit of summer debris on the beaches. One of the what we would ask our volunteers, we're desperately in need of volunteers. We assemble at Kate's Park at 10 o'clock and divide into groups and go to certain sections of the beach. And what you would need for that, to make sure you're comfortable doing that, is sturdy shoes, because we have a very rocky beach in places, most places, and fairly sturdy gloves, like an old pair of gardening gloves, something like that. The thin rubber gloves don't work because you're picking up glass and stuff like that.
So people are coming, encouraged to go over the Second Narrows Bridge, go along Dollerton Highway for about 10 kilometers, and they'll see a big sign there that says Kate's Park.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Take the first exit to the right up the Indian Arm, come to Kate's Park, or Way o' Witchen, as the First Nations call it, and then at 10 o'clock tomorrow.
Yes, at the Kate's Park concession stand. There'll be a big awning there advertising the North Vancouver Save Our Shores Society, so you won't miss where you have to be as long as you wend your way down to the concession stand.
Now Maureen, you've done this for 7 years, and I'll be there tomorrow. I just love walking along that shore. It gives me an opportunity to be with you folks. And so what is it that you'll mostly pick up there? What is it? How much do you think?
Well, I have to say that because we've been doing this, the first year we did it, we needed about 4 dump trucks. Now we only 4 dumpsters. Now we only need about 2 at the most. And the most of the stuff we find now, because people have stopped, they have started taking their takeout food wrappers and that kind of stuff off the beach. But what we do find a lot of is glass, broken glass, and many pounds of cigarette butts. And I don't know if the people realize that a cigarette butt takes about 10 years to break down in the environment. And they lodge in all the rock crevices. And also, they're not very good for fish habitat. So really, it's probably nice and relaxing for people to smoke on the beach, but maybe they should try a way of taking their butts with them when they go.
Well, I have this phrase, Maureen. It says, when people throw their butts on the ground at random, and now they're throwing it on the beaches, I would kindly ask them whether they thought the world was their ashtray.
That's right. That's right. The broken glass, now this is all a matter of education, and this is why we keep doing this, to raise public awareness, because there's also the people that discard maybe a bottle over the side of a boat. After they've drunk their beverage, they toss their can over or their bottle. Well, bottles, of course, get smashed up against the rocks. And then you have broken glass buried in the sand, and that's very unkind to wet feet of little children.
No.
You know, no. Because you can't see it. And there's quite big shards of glass buried in along the beach.
Now, Maureen, there are many things that we don't see. I mean, what we can see, we can pick up tomorrow on the beach shores of North Vancouver. But there are many things we don't see, and that is that, I think the city is really slow in advertising the coliform counts in Deep Cove, and that they're always above the safe levels. Maybe you can just give us a little rundown why that should be.
They've tried to come up with a solution for that for many, many years, and they really don't know for sure. I wonder if maybe there's a thorough check of the homes up the Indian Arm that are on septic tank, that kind of thing. Septic tanks can be, the modern ones are very, very good, but I just wonder if maybe people haven't checked or don't take as much care of their septic tanks as they should, or there's maybe an abandoned one or something like that. But to me, it doesn't seem to be that it can be all Canada geese or whatever it is that they figure causes this. The other problem is that up the Indian Arm, it doesn't have a flushing out process like most rivers and streams do. The waters there do not sort of flush out the arm, so that might be a cause too. It's very difficult to know, But these are things we can check ourselves to make sure we're not guilty of being the cause.
Now, the fact remains is that in the summer, the coliform count goes up, in winter it goes down.
Yeah, well, so it might, you know, if there's summer cottages, it does make you wonder.
Yeah, and many of these cottages are built literally on rocks, and, how could they, there's no septic field for this to dilute into the ground.
Well, with the new kinds of septic tanks, they're in concrete, of course, I believe. There are two kinds of systems. There's the kind where you do a septic field if you have the room, and then there's a kind where you sort of sink some kind of a shaft, I think, which operates in the same way but downwards instead of across. I'm not quite sure if that's a fact, but I believe in constricted areas they do have a different method to the field system.
Now, the reason I'm emphasizing this sewage thing is because we had the people on from the talking about the processes that happened under Lionsgate Bridge before you were on, but also that I feel that the seagulls and Canada geese are being unfairly maligned.
Yes,
here.
Probably because they've been around.
And that's an easy one to target. They don't speak back.
No, now I do believe the population of them has increased, but I don't think they would be the main cause. I think probably because of our increased population, that may have more to do with it than the wild animals, so to speak. But I don't know, because this is not something I'm an expert on. But anyone that has a summer cottage up the Indian Arm maybe should be very, very careful about their septic systems and make sure that they're all running properly. And a proper septic system installed works very well. But there are kinds, I mean, I've known of leaking into the environment, and that's where maybe if that's happening with your septic tank, then you must rectify it.
That's right. Now, we also know that much of the sewage is going with the tidal waters up Indian Arm, that many of these chemicals like PCBs and that the fish are in this area for months, they're being polluted, and the much of the fecal matter from 76,000 households settles on the ground, and the crabs grow to record sizes, and people think this is good food to eat.
Yeah, makes you wonder, doesn't it?
It makes one wonder.
Very good.
So,
but there is, and that's something, as I say, if you're living on the Indian Arm or close to it, is something that you should be aware of, and I'm sure the people are that live up there, that I don't quite understand it, but the flushing system, it doesn't flush out the way it should, you know, or in other areas do. Mother Nature cannot take care of it 100%.
Now, Maureen Bragg is a board member of Save Our Shores, and if you could just repeat, encourage people to come out to your joyous event at Kate's Park tomorrow at 10 o'clock.
Yeah, meet at 10 a.m. at the concession stand, rain or shine, but we've been promised shine, and bring a pair of fairly substantial gloves if you've got them. If you just don't have any around the house, I think we'll have some that we can supply you with. But sturdy footwear, not thongs. It just doesn't work on rocks.
And it's a wonderful walk, because on the other side you've got Belcarra Park.
Well, I was down there yesterday with my grandchildren, and it's great. It's beautiful down there. It really is.
Thank you, the work you do for the Save Our Shores and for being on Animal Voices. Maureen Bragg.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
And bye-bye, Maureen. And shortly we'll be having Hazel Smeltzer on the line. She has a little story, and but in the meantime, we're going to have Alan, do you have a little bit of a tune for us? A tune, just a short one. And nice.
Mm-hmm.
and you, yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. Animal Voices has a web page, and it's being reconstructed at the moment, but many of our programs are posted there. It's www.animalvoices.org. Go and check it out. There's lots of information also about many of the different subjects that everybody should know. Well, Hazel Smelser comes in all the way from Langley. She was here last week, told us a wonderful story about chickens, and well, what have you on the line today for us, Hazel?
Well, you know what? I thought I would talk about animal psychics because I find this a very fascinating story. I'm just fascinated that there is such a thing as animal psychics. And some people might think that you're a little bit crazy when you think that you're talking about animal psychics. But I've met a few people that had some pretty awesome experiences. So one of them I just wanted to share was I take my disabled child to a special riding stable called Valley Therapeutic in Langley, and he rides these horses. And I was speaking to the physiotherapist one day that was working with my boy on the horse, and I was walking beside him on the horse, and she was telling me an interesting story about a friend of hers who just so happened to ended up, I knew this woman, and that lives up in Vernon, and she has a ranch, and she has this horse that she had had for many, many years. And but the horse was always kind of ornery and bad-tempered, and had his always had his own way, and kind of a difficult horse to manage. And she heard that there was an animal psychic in town in Vernon, and so she invited her to come to her ranch. And this lady, you know, is not into psychic things or supernatural anything, just a regular woman that, you know, is a rancher and has her horses. And anyways, she thought it was interesting to have this lady come and speak with her horse that has some behavior problems. And she said that the horse said to her that he didn't like his name. And she had gotten this horse, bought this horse maybe, she had it for about 8 years and had bought it from someone else and given it a new name. And the horse did not like the name. And so the psychic asked, you know, I guess she connected with the horse. And the horse told her the name that he would like to be called. And so they changed his name, and the whole demeanor of the horse changed, behavior changed, and turned into a totally different horse. And so I thought that was a really fascinating story.
You know, we had some people on here who communicate with horses on our program before. And you know, I truly believe that is so, that there's, we should, and she spoke about how we communicate with animals. And we must listen to them. And, you know, next week we'll have a wonderful horse person on our program. That's going to be Seneca Crossland from I think lives in Penticton. And she'll be talking about that some 100,000, 90,000 horses are slaughtered in North America for human consumption in Europe and Asia every year. Can you imagine? Mm. And, you know, this is happening right here on our doorstep. And 10,000 more horses are exported from Canada to the United States to be slaughtered, you know, in other countries. Because the horses suffer horribly on the way during the slaughter and transportation, and then they're put to death. Imagine, it's like putting, they're so personal. And of course, Canadians for the Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, CETFA, is very much involved with the treatment of the transportation of animals. So we have, thank you for bringing up that very personal story. And so Seneca Crossland will be on about Premarin horses and horse slaughter in North America, and we have the great privilege, the co-host of Animal Voices, our webmaster, animalvoices.org, John Pranger, and welcome, John Pranger.
Thank you, Carl. Great story. Well, let's talk a little bit about animal vivisection, which, and I'll start by quoting from two doctors, if I may. Practically all animal experiments are untenable on a statistical scientific basis, for they possess no scientific validity or reliability. They merely perform an alibi function for pharmaceutical companies who hope to protect themselves thereby. And that's written by Herbert Stiller, medical doctor, and Margot Stiller, his wife, medical doctor, both from Hanover. So an alibi function for pharmaceutical companies. They can say they've made all the appropriate tests, and therefore they cannot be liable to any injuries that they do to human, admitting very well that they do commit these things. But they're shielded from this legislation, which obliges them, or it doesn't force them to experiment on animals, and then they can declare these substances safe, although it's a well-known physiological fact that all animals react differently to different substances from human beings. The second quote is from a doctor writing in 1928, and he's Dr. Houtekijt, in a letter to the newspaper Etoile Belge, a Belgian newspaper, July 3, 1927, he said, "Every profession contains some conceited incompetence, a profession more than other ones. But why must it be that thousands of victims whose ingeniously thought-out torments the general public has not the least idea of should suffer in this way for a so-called scientific or medical piece of flashy publicity?" Well, lots of flashy publicity goes out for vaccines because they're an enormous moneymaker for the vaccine establishment or for the medical establishment. And how many people really know how these vaccines are made? Well, many of them were worked out. Of course, all of them are worked out on animals and animal tissue. The green monkey was virtually wiped out from this planet due to that monkey being used to manufacture the polio vaccine. Well, it was nothing but polio, according to many experts. So a whole species of animals nearly wiped out by the doctors, and now they're trying to get hold of the last individuals or chimps to manufacture a deadly AIDS vaccine, which is bound to be just as deadly and costly as the polio vaccine was proven to be. Well, according to many people, I'm reading from a book written in 1982, and I'll just read it verbatim pretty much. Polio is another disease, according to this author, of body poisoning and nutritional deficiency, and not a virus disease at all. It is a man-made disease and is kept going by the poison vaccine shots and wrong diets, plus other types of body poisoning. When I, the author, went to the Los Angeles Health Department and asked for a set of the package inserts for the vaccines being given in this country, they refused at first, as I was not a medical doctor. But I finally got them. However, I noticed that there was no polio vaccine listed. I'd heard that the Salk polio vaccine had been banned because it had killed and paralyzed so many people over the past 30 years. The numerous multi-million dollar lawsuits had confirmed that. They told me that there used to be six firms making it in the U.S., but the only vaccine lab now making the Salk vaccine is in Canada. But the Sabin polio vaccine, the oral vaccine, was still available. One of our government officials stated that about the only polio we see around here today is caused by the Sabin vaccine. So I suppose it soon will be phased out. It hasn't, of course. It's still going very strong, especially in the third world. It hardly seems worthwhile to waste space giving the description of process for making Salk vaccine, as it is a dead issue. But for those who want to know something about the Salk vaccine, which was so vigorously promoted in the 50s, the following is the account as given by the Vaccination Inquirer, published in England. Under the title of The Making of Polio Vaccine, we read this: modern methods of production. While some of the older methods are still being used, tissue culture techniques are replacing a number of them. Vaccinia virus can readily be grown in tissue culture made from chick embryos. So imagine lots of eggs are used in this manufacture now. And most viruses can be grown on chopped tissues, dropped or suspended in a nutrient medium, that is blood, calf blood. A general outline of the technique for growing vaccine virus for poliomyelitis is now given. Rhesus monkeys are infected with the virus of infantile paralysis, that is to say polio, and when they are paralyzed, they are killed. Then the kidneys are removed. These are immediately decapsulated and chopped up into small pieces and placed into a nutrient medium. And this is calf blood. A pre-warmed solution of trypsin, a digestive enzyme, is added and it is stirred. About 20 minutes later, the fluid is discarded and another solution of trypsin is added. After a further 20 minutes, the solution is decanted into sterile tubes. A 2% calf serum and nutrient medium is added, and eventually a portion of the stock virus preparation is introduced. The cultures are replaced in the incubator, and degeneration of the cells due to the virus becomes apparent within two or three days. All the material is pooled, and the cell debris is allowed to settle in the cold. The supernatant fluid is carefully decanted off and filtered. It contains the crude virus preparation. In the case of Salk vaccine, formalin is then added to kill the viruses. Samples are then dialyzed free of formalin and tested in tissue culture for living virus. The general form of preparation of other vaccines is similar, and when living viruses, virus vaccines are required, the killing stage with formalin is omitted.
John, I can ask a question here. You're talking about, you know, how these cultures are made.
Mm-hmm.
But you talk about polio, but this is a past situation, a dead issue. Why do you talk about polio?
Well, there's a whole general principle involved in that people say that polio...
You should talk about what's being happening now.
Well, polio was wiped out, according to the profession here in North America and Europe, but that's not the case at all. It was abolished because it was the only cause of polio in the United States.
What was abolished?
Polio, the polio vaccine. It wasn't because they had eliminated it, the disease, with vaccination, although credit is given to the vaccine programs that is supposed to have eliminated polio in the Western world. Well, it didn't. It caused it, and they abolished the vaccine because it caused vaccine
okay.
poisoning.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry for interrupting.
Okay. Well,
I wasn't quite understanding it.
I see. Okay. Well, what's happening is that we are getting a whole whack of poison directly implanted into the blood, and there are casualties proven to be. It may be one in a million, it may be one in 100,000, but if it's your child that's wrecked or killed, you know, it's not so expedient to say, well, some must be sacrificed in order for others to live.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the principle that has been adopted by the doctors. But they have never proven through epidemiological study, a controlled study, that vaccines actually save lives, or that they, and any studies that have been undertaken, not sort of causal study, but I guess you might call them incidental study, have shown, for example, 2 years ago, the CDC came out with the fact that the flu vaccine had not prevented the disease that it was supposed to have prevented. Okay, so old people being vaccinated with flu
virus. Viruses mutate so rapidly.
Yes, that's one reason, because they can never guess what's coming, and so they throw... you have something to say about that, yeah. A little comment by
Hazel.
I just wanted to say that I had a personal experience, very bad experience with the flu vaccine.
And you're a nurse, right? You're an ex-nurse?
No, I'm a nurse's aide.
Nurse's aide, okay.
But I did have I had a flu shot about 3 years ago. I became very, very ill, and I couldn't speak. And I became kind of confused and mixed up, and I was very scared. And I wasn't well for about a week. Ended up that I had mercury poisoning from the mercury, just a small amount of mercury, which is in the flu vaccine.
It's minuscule, and they say it's not enough to harm.
Yes, but I am poisoned with mercury.
Wow.
And I have been going through chelation.
Wow.
And so I went to my family doctor, and he said, nonsense, no, it's not the flu vaccine. But I went to my naturopath, and they said, yeah, well, they checked my chart. So, well, you're so contaminated with mercury, Hazel, that there's absolutely no way you should be taking any vaccines whatsoever, because just that little bit just put it right over the edge. So they are very dangerous.
Now, I had experience last week when I cut my finger with a bow saw, and I had to have 3 stitches in there, and the physician asked me how long ago I had had my tetanus vaccine. So was it within the last 10 years? I didn't know, of course, but I said no. And then she said, have you had it within the last 5 years? I said no. And she said, do you think you should have a tetanus? I said, no, I don't think I need to have any mercury or formaldehyde in my system.
Or animal viruses, thank you very much.
End quote.
Yes.
Thank you. And did I think, I said to Beverly afterwards, did I think that the tetanus virus was sitting at the end of my bow saw to infect me and that I needed to have a vaccine?
Are you doubting the vaccine paradigm? Because, you know,
I think everything should be
tearing the whole world up.
Everything should be questioned.
Yes.
And we question so much in this world here.
But it can't do any good, Carl, considering the fact animals have to suffer for this idea. And yes, that is the bottom line for me.
Thank you, John. And thank you, Hazel. And what we have, we'll end off with how we started the program, with a quote from Gandhi. And Gandhi said that the strength of a nation can be judged by how it treats its weakest. And Leo Tolstoy, that great author, he wrote and he said, as long as there are slaughterhouses, there will be battlefields. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices.